Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to our proceedings this morning. I'd like to welcome Colonel Bruce back. I am sure that you will have a sense that you have been missed, because I'm sure people will have questions reserved for you for no other reason than the fact that you've been missed, obviously. So we'll get to those in a few moments. But Mr. Lambrick, I believe you have some exhibits that have been tabled this evening or this morning that you wish to speak to.
Yes, sir. I understand these are distributed to my friends and to the staff of the panel. They arise from undertakings that were extended earlier in the week. There was a request to produce the letters respecting the well known as the Nishimoto well, and these are 003052, a letter of 15th of September 2005, and 003053, a letter of September 21st, 2005. And then secondly, a request to produce the annual reports for the CFB Suffield National Wildlife Area for 2006 and 2007. And the 2006 annual report is 003054. And the 2007 annual report is 003055.
Thank you, Mr. Lambrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Just to reintroduce myself to the panel, my name is Keith Miller, and I'm counsel for CERC. As it appears that my panel may be appearing today, I'm appearing to file the curricula vitae of my witnesses, and what I've done is I've combined them as one document, sir. I would propose to enter them as one exhibit, and they consist of the curricula vitae of Stephen E. Moffitt, who is the president of CERC, and Mr. Robert Barron, who is the supervisor of range safety for CERC as well. And the next exhibit number for CERC would be 008-003, and I've assigned that on the document itself, sir, if I might have that filed.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I'll just distribute copies.
Okay. All right, I believe we're ready to begin the cross-examination of Commander Bruce, and we'll begin with the coalition, followed by NCANA, then Mr. Musso with the Secretariat, and then ourselves. Ms. Klemek, please proceed.
Sir, sorry to interrupt. My sense is this is the appropriate time for these sort of matters. There was one other undertaking given to Mr. Jensen yesterday in respect of three citations from the literature review that he conducted, and if it's appropriate now, Mr. Jensen was going to respond to that undertaking orally.
Yes, this is an appropriate moment for that to occur. Mr. Jensen, please.
Yeah, good morning. This was in reference to a request from Mr. Denstedt for three references with respect to our systematic review. I'll just preface this by saying most of the information on the systematic review can be found in exhibit number 003C-006, which is the Environment Canada reply to information requests, and specifically the reply to NCANA number 69. I'll go through these documents one by one briefly. The first reference was to a paper by Foreman, Renikin, and Herbstberger in 2002. Entitled Road Traffic and Nearby Grassland Bird Patterns in a Suburbanizing Landscape. The effect we noted for that paper was negative, so the effect of traffic on grassland birds is negative. However, our reviewers noted that the paper didn't contain our target species and contained different grassland bird communities. With respect to data quality, it was an artificial study design. Analytical flaws interfered with effect size interpretation. confounding factors were partially controlled, there were biased observation methods, and an inadequate sampling intensity. So therefore, the paper was not used in a meta-analysis. It was reviewed, and it was not cited except in our Excel sheet summary of all of our citations. The second paper is a paper by Miller, Knight, and Miller in 1998, entitled Influence of Recreational Trails on Breeding Bird Communities. We noted the effect of trails on the abundance of birds to be negative. Our reviewers indicated this was a good paper with a realistic study design. The analytical methods were robust. The confounding factors were controlled experimentally. Unbiased observation methods and adequate sampling intensity. So this paper was used in our meta-analysis and cited in the Government of Canada submission. The last paper is a paper by Engelfinger and Anderson in 2004 entitled Passerin Response to Roads Associated with Natural Gas Extraction in a Sagebrush Steppe Habitat. So this paper noted that the effect of shallow gas on grassland birds was negative. It's not included in the meta-analysis. It did not specifically address any of the grassland birds in our project, but addressed some conspecifics or similar species. As I said, it was cited. It was not used in the meta-analysis and was used as a supplemental citation. I believe one important note is from the abstract of the paper, and I'll cite it here, and I quote, "Well, a 39 to 60% reduction in grassland obligates within 100 meters of a single road may not be biologically significant. The density of roads created during natural gas development and extraction compounds the effect, and the area of impact can be substantial. Traffic volume alone may not sufficiently explain observed declines adjacent to roads, and sagebrush obligates may also be responding to edge effects, habitat fragmentation, and increases in other passerin species along road corridors. Therefore, declines may persist after traffic associated with extraction subsides and perhaps until roads are fully reclaimed," end quote. Now, one final note is that the reference to being biologically significant is important. We had, in our meta-analysis, come up with a final number showing the associated decreases in abundance of grassland birds in proximity to trails associated with shallow gas development. And we again modeled that across the entire landscape, showing potentially a reduction in 25% of abundance of grassland birds in shallow gas infield projects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Mr. Denstad?
I have a couple of questions arising out of that response.
Please proceed.
So, Mr. Jensen, in the last paper, would that have been included in your scorecard as a negative paper?
That's correct.
All right, and in respect of the Engelfinger paper, the low traffic volumes there were 700 to 710 vehicles per day.
Yeah, and that's a mistake in the abstract. It should read 7 to 10 vehicles per day.
Okay, and in the in that paper, in respect of Highway 351, a paved road, the average there was 344 vehicles per day, and Engelfinger indicated that there no significant decline was detected in respect of Highway 351. Isn't that correct?
I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Denstad. That completes the undertakings, I understand. Then, Ms. Klimek, please continue or begin your cross-examination this morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, panel members. Good morning, NCANA panel. Seems like it wasn't that long we saw you all. Now, I'm going to start with a few questions for you, Mr. Didiak, out of the materials that you had produced and where we had left, where you and I had left off in our discussion last time, or when we were up. Now, I promise to be slow today. Now, I heard someone say, but not too slow, back here.
That qualifier is important, yeah.
No one's anxious to be on their way, I can tell. Now, Mr. Didiuk, when we had to stop our questioning to allow for the information to be provided, you were explaining what you had found with snakes and traffic and mortality. And I'm wondering if you could do a brief overview of that, because I have some questions, and that seems like a year ago that we talked about that. So could you just give us a brief overview of what you were talking about when we had to stop?
Yes, we were engaged in my description of some of the information we had pertaining to four main areas of the proposed mitigation measures that of Encana in their EPP. And at the time, we were engaged in discussing the Environment Canada's consideration of efficiency of the proposed speed limits and the factors that have to be considered as far as trying to inform the panel of how these proposed how speed limits can not be a very effective mitigation measure.
Now, what did you, in a Coles Notes version, find through that series of work that you did on slowing down speed limits and what the effect was on snake mortality and your conclusions on that?
The Coles Note version is that consistently, even a person who's focused on trying to detect snakes on this pilot study, consistently, almost entirely, was able to safely stop their survey vehicle approximately 35 meters beyond the position of the snake. I emphasize safely. I emphasize the fact that it's a person who's trying to see snakes, and it's also a circumstance that it's related to the factors of allowing a driver to see a snake, and this is related to the fact that they're cryptic. There's all kinds of other things on the road that interfere with you seeing a snake, and various factors such as that. So it's very difficult for someone who's trying to see a snake to actually stop.
Now, if we could turn to your one of the documents you produced, 00351, mm-hmm. and at page 47, I think you set out some of your conclusions on this. Do you have that in front of you?
Yes, I do.
And you're finding, I believe, and this is leading into some questions, development of shallow gas fields, which began in 1999, greatly increased traffic. This high traffic is expected to continue, and the increased density of well-accessed trails will result in increased traffic over the long term for maintenance. And I guess in light of that and what you've seen, what would you expect would happen with snakes as a result of that? What would be your prognosis?
I can address that with two considerations. One would require me to indicate to the panel, address some of the Encana's suppositions that there are a few snakes killed right now. There are lots of snakes, and so it's not a problem. These are what I consider to be subjective opinions that are in the October 7th transcript. I can provide a page reference. I believe it's page 761. However, Environment Canada, in my experience, I believe I can bring to play some information and actual data to show that this is not the case. Environment Canada has indicated that there's a very large volume of scientific information and publications that indicate that some species, particularly some ones such as the prairie rattlesnake, in fact can only withstand, perhaps you can use that term, a very small loss, particularly of reproductively aged females. Environment Canada's submission has referred to an excellent study on a similar species in Ontario, the black rat snake, suggesting that only 1.5% of adult female mortality due to rodent mortality is enough to precipitate long-term declines. Having this demographic limitation of rattlesnakes, what I'd like to make very clear is that even though there may appear to be a small number of snakes, and I'll return to that in a moment, when the, for example, and in Canada's 2006 road survey monitoring program, and there may appear to be a lot of snakes, as in Canada has presented, that is not necessarily the case when we look at there's actually a smaller number of important reproductive adult females as part of the effective population size. And the number of snakes we see on the road has to be modified by several factors to actually come up with a more appropriate estimate of how many are actually being killed. I can provide some a quick walkthrough if the panel should decide to look at these three numbers, because what we need to do to come up with potential effects is look at three numbers. How many snakes are there? How many snakes have to be killed to start population declines? And how many snakes are actually being killed?
I think that would be helpful.
I'll try and do the Coles Note version of this again. I think it's quite possible. One moment. I want to emphasize that I'm using an excellent study as a model for us to walk us through very quickly, and some information we have both from our Environment Canada submission and from Canada's own snake monitoring program. However, I'd like to emphasize that there is an opportunity to do some more robust modeling in this regard. The Government of Canada indicated to the panel that this was a deficiency when we reviewed the EIS, and Canada remained silent in this respect. But I think this process I'll take you through right now can demonstrate the important facts that I've been alluding to. First of all, we'll just confine ourselves to a portion of the wildlife area that's south of Interface to the south boundary of the National Wildlife Area, because this is where we have quite a bit of information that's needed to go through this exercise. We'll also confine ourselves to reproductive age females, because as I've mentioned, these are the most susceptible proportion component as far as population decline, keeping in mind that other age sex classes, males, and other snakes also are being killed and contribute to the population maintenance or decline. In Appendix G of our Environment Canada submission, we provided regression curves of capture frequencies at all our drift fences that we intercept snakes moving from the river. I won't go through all the factors, but what we can do, what anyone can do, perhaps I've heard the term a practitioner in our hearings, if a herpetologist practitioner in this field would do several things. We'd use these intercept values in terms of how many snakes are captured near the river, are originating from the river. We multiply by the number of traps we've set up and what percentage we're intercepting along that front of movement. We adjust accordingly for several factors. I've tried to be conservative in this exercise as far as some snakes may go around these fences. We've done studies to show that hardly any go over. And we would adjust for the number of adult females because of proportion, their biennial breeding or triennial breeding. We introduce a factor that account for how many snakes aren't being intercepted. So the number we come up with is in this area I've described south of Interface, I feel there's an effective breeding population estimate for reproductive females of 575 adult females. Now, I've tried to be conservative in this estimate. I'm comfortable with it. Based on using some other information over the years, we've had very large, long 500-meter, 1-kilometer-long fences along the river. We've studied several hibernacula complete counts, and we've evaluated potential on the river. So I'm comfortable with this number as a, for a demonstration exercise. So let's move on to the second number. How many snakes have to be killed to precipitate a decline? From this study on black rat lakes that's referenced, Blue and Demers and Weatherhead, it's also it's an excellent study, over 10 years of studying the population demographics, and most importantly, several years of monitoring rattles, black snakes with radio telemetry to look at their mortality, including on roads. They've indicated 1.5 to 2% of these females have to die to start declines. In this exercise, I'll be conservative. Let's say 4%. I think the rattlesnake is more vulnerable, but I'll use a 4% mortality rate. So using that that value, I think we're looking at approximately, let me just check because I want to get this. We have 570 female rattlesnakes, but only 23 of these very important snakes have to be killed to initiate a decline. I'm not talking about a precipitous decline, but a long-term decline. So now we can move on to the third number. How many snakes are actually being killed? We've heard testimony from in Canada that there's a small number of snakes. This is something we've struggled with through our cooperative efforts, but I can try and quickly walk you. I'm trying to do the Coles Note version. I'm almost done.
This is important, so don't be worried about...
Well, this has been a central issue we've been cooperatively trying to deal with over the years. In Canada's 2006 snake monitoring program, detected nine dead rattlesnakes on Bingville and Interface. The terror report that described this is not particularly clear in many respects, but to our, based on our information on snake dispersal, we know that very few juvenile rattlesnakes get this far, and that's presented in our Appendix G. So we can assume these are adult rattlesnakes. Now, we know that the sex ratio is similar. They're approximately equal from our studies, and it's typical. We know that female rattlesnakes, based on the information in Appendix G, tend to go a little bit less far. It's the males that are trying to find them. They tend to go a little farther. So let's see, of these nine rattlesnakes that were found, let's say four of them are female, adult females. So now we have to look at what the study was doing. They were, there was focused, the surveys were focused on the vicinity of Bingville and the Interface at the end. We know from our other many years of study, and we know that concurrently there's operational activities going on throughout that whole area south of Interface. We can expect that other snakes are being killed that were not detected by that survey effort. So let's be conservative and let's say half as much again. Another couple of female rattlesnakes were killed. So now we're up to six. Then we have to look at how many aren't detected. When a snake is hit by a vehicle, it doesn't necessarily stay there. On pavement, that quite often happens, on a resisting surface. On these gravel roads, they may be hit in the lower portion of the body, pinched. The study on black rat snakes indicated that for every snake found on a road, two were found off the road. I don't think that's the case. I think it was a rather a small, because there are some limitations on their sample size, so let's be conservative and say for every snake found on the road, one is found off. So now we have to double that number. So now we're at 12 adult female rattlesnakes. And then the final factor to try and adjust to get an approximation of how many were killed on roads is this study was conducted in the months of May and June, 2 months during the movement period of snakes. We can expect that additional snakes were killed in the months of July and August, which at that Bingville area in particular, but we're talking about the whole area, and in September. It's a 5.5 month dispersal period, so let's be conservative again and let's just double. So right now, at this point, we're at 24 dead rattlesnakes on the roads. We're not talking about any interactions and caissons, entrapment by caissons and other. But let's just be conservative. I'm trying to make a best case for, I guess, in Canada. We predicted that based on this excellent model example and reasonable estimate of population size that we're at that threshold, and this is a conservative effort. Now, I want to emphasize to the panel that I've gone through this modeling exercise And we can, and I'd be happy to do it with, is we can say, well, was it 5 and 9 here, or was it 570, 600? I'm trying to indicate two things here, that these are reasonable approximations of these three important variables. And I'm also trying to demonstrate that perceptions of number of snakes on the road are a great underestimate of what you see. So in my opinion, and this is supported by a large volume in the scientific literature that the EIS is silent upon, is that this is a, in the profession of herpetology conservation, road mortality after habitat loss is the biggest issue. So in my judgment, at the current time and level, and at some time in the past, road mortality as an additive mortality factor is very likely promoting long-term declines. And I can provide that, put that for the panel. And what I've described is a process. If the panel wishes, I can very briefly, hopefully a better Cole's version, put that in a context in terms of what the panel is seeking. Is this impact, how do I interpret this as a significant and adverse impact?
Thank you for that summary, Mr. Didier.
Now, Mr. Didiak, on the same page, we go down to mitigation. And what you said here is the most effective means of mitigating mortality of snakes due to traffic is through diversion of traffic from the areas where snakes are concentrated or traveling. Now, does that mean diversion? Do you mean not having them go through that area?
I can clarify for that for you, and I'll refer to perhaps a comment of my colleague, Ms. Brenda Dale, yesterday when she says, if there's one thing I wish, I would not use the particular term. I think under examination from Mr. Musso yesterday regarding these proposed exclusion zones, that term sounds a little severe in terms of no activity. I would prefer you to consider the term we're looking at restriction zones. In our Environment Canada submission, we're suggesting that a meaningful reduction in the activity related to well visits and other associated activity is what we're seeking for in these spatial temporal zones. The history of our cooperative studies with DND, CERC, and NCANA in the early part of this decade, a lot of effort was addressing what we consider to be possible mitigation efforts, the speed limits and public education programs. Our conclusion was that these could not be effective for a variety of reasons I could discuss, but what was needed was not drastic but effective redirection of a bulk of traffic. And the initial step that NCANA and CERC and DND and Canadian Wildlife Service and PFRA collectively decided was to make an initial step, and as I stress initial, is the point of entry considerations, the Bingville entry away from the river versus South Buffalo. And this was good. And this was lauded by the herpetological conservation community when this was presented at conferences. This was a step forward. But it was always an understanding, and I think it's based on what we all know is common sense, is that although we changed the point of entry farther away from the river to reduce the risk, and we demonstrated that in this 2003 report, the true challenge is to be what happens to that traffic distribution after it enters Bingville, because we all know that eventually they're going to have to go and do their business. And so what Environment Canada has presented in this 2003 report, which was provided in Canada, that we stressed, it provided the data, and it also stated, and bear with me for one moment, I think it's on. I can't find the exact page, but we made a statement saying this is a possible effective means of mitigation. And the last comment I'll make in this regard is that in our written Environment Canada submission and in our submission a couple of days ago, we have proposed this as a possible mitigation measure. I can't make a determination if Encana will be able to even use this to make it effectively, and I'll give you three reasons why that is. At the time we were formulating this recommendation, we were at a certain level of wells per section and level of activity. Can Encana actually redirect traffic for visits outside these zones in the winter, what have you, effectively to reach a level that I think, since we know that we believe that additive mortality was causing population declines at the around the 2000 year period, year 2000, and likely even in our earlier studies back in the early 90s. I don't know. They have to go through that exercise. This exercise would also have to be tempered by it, because what we're looking at, we've heard about traffic, and what is needed is is a network analysis of traffic. Where is it occurring? And this is a process that would have to be tempered by other environmental restraints. And one in particular is that if in Canada can effectively direct this traffic outside these periods in the summer, does that create a problem, let's say, with antelope considerations? So it's an exercise that has to be done. I'm not sure if it's possible, but I feel in view of the ineffectiveness of traffic limits and education programs, this is the only possibility at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Didiuk. Now I'd like to turn to the two letters that were produced, which are 00352 and 00353. And I'll start with the first one, which is September 15th. And as I take it, these last two letters were the ones that were effective in getting the well out of the Nishimoto wetland. Is that correct?
Fernando Martins, yes.
And one of the reasons I asked for this letter was what was the or else? And I think that was on the 00352, the last paragraph. I'll read it to you, and then I'll ask you, Mr. Martins. The issue has been ongoing for too long and not in the spirit of cooperation. The well at grid 279901/LSD, and then the legal, is to be removed by October 1st, 2005, or I will close all Encana access to the CFB subfield except for maintenance purposes. Now, I take it that was what the base was prepared to do if the well was not removed. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, going to the next letter, which is 003523, again, I take it this was in response, there was something done in response to the previous letter, and this is the response of the base to that response.
That is my understanding, yes.
Okay. Now, I have a few questions about this, and I'm going to paragraph one. References to A and J above, and there's a whole list of things, detail a litany of exchanges between CERC and CFB Suffield regarding the subject well. And then it says, to summarize, the well is in a wetland. CERC supervisor range safety was directed to have the subject well removed on September 10th, 2004. And 10 months and 3 formal written directives later, the well remains. And I'm just going to read a bit of the next paragraph, and then I have some questions. Reference one is the last of the formal written directives. Reference I, and that was the previous letter that we just discussed. Reference J is President CERC's counterproposal to discuss yet again this issue. The counterproposal reflects CERC's strategy of deny, delay, deter, and deflect, an approach to doing business in the CFB Suffield training area that will no longer be tolerated. Now, my question is, why is CERC the party that you're dealing with on this well? Is it not Encana's well?
First of all, Mr. Chairman and distinguished panel members, thank you for accommodating my absence for the last 2 days. I did miss it. I do want to answer this question. I think it's important, as you know, CERC was established under the 1999 partial assignment agreement, at which time over the course of several years, it was decided that in order to provide one focus point or funnel point for all our discussions with industry, as you can appreciate, there are more than one company operating on the CF Suffield block. Encana is by far the largest, but not the only one. And CERC provided that sort of entry into industry, and as well was used as a funnel from industry into the base. And that's generally speaking why it was being sent through CERC at that particular time. I will note, though, that based on these letters and a couple of other issues that occurred, by the time of my arrival in 2007, my predecessor had decided to go directly to the companies rather than dealing with CERC because he found that he was no longer able to effectively communicate with industry. I will say that over the past year, again, I have gone back to using CERC primarily as my funnel point, mainly on the bequest of all the oil and gas companies on the block, as they were finding it quite challenging to keep up with the correspondence at times between myself and industry. And therefore, we continue now to use CERC as a funnel point, but reserve the right, as we always do, to communicate directly to individual companies as needed.
So looking back at these letters then, when you would give a request to the company to do something, then it would be CERC who would respond with the company's position, or was it CERC's, or how did, I guess, that work historically?
Again, a very interesting question. I think that in many cases, some of this was personality-driven. I will say there has been management changes in CERC over the course of the last couple of years, and therefore the personalities within the organization are somewhat different. The individual or individuals that were involved with CERC at the time, I believe, felt, and I'm not speaking for my predecessor because I don't purport to do so, however, they believe they had much more authority than they actually had. They are there to assist and to resolve issues, but they are not there to speak on the behalf of other operators necessarily.
Now, Colonel Bruce, it's our turn to ask you some questions generally. And some of these have come out of answers that we received when you're in your absence, and you'll be pleased to know many of the people said, talk to the colonel about that. So I guess the buck stops there. Now, what I'd like to talk about, and the majority of my questions to you are to deal with enforcement and understanding when things go wrong. So for the next little bit, and we have to look historically, and I know you may have been there for some, but the purpose of that is how are you going to be dealing with things in the future? Are they changing? So that's the framework within which I'm going to be asking the next questions, okay? Now, I guess before you can enforce, you have to find out if things are going well or not well. Now, what methods does the base have to determine whether companies are complying with their permits, the laws, what they're supposed to be doing?
Compliance has always been a significant issue on the base. As you can appreciate, with 10,500 wells plus the ancillary infrastructure, 300-plus vehicles a day on average entering and exit from industry, as well as a limited organization in terms of my range control and my range sustainability section. Compliance is mainly done on a spot check basis rather than a complete audit, if you will, or check. I have instituted a number of initiatives to ensure that, as I mentioned before in my opening statement, that I am more comfortable with what is going on out on the base. And as I have also previously mentioned, that up until this last year, it was easier for an oil and gas worker to get on my base than it was for one of my own employees, which I found completely unacceptable. To that end, we've done a couple of things. First of all, I've issued an amplification letter to CERC earlier this year to basically provide direction on the things that I want them to accomplish on my behalf, primarily ensuring that all the necessary authorities for an individual from industry must have before they're allowed to cross the gate, so to speak, to enter into the range and training area. And those authorities range from a safety briefing to ensuring they know where they're going to go and what they're going to do and what routes they're entitled to have. It also ensures that the vehicles meet all the necessary standards and simple things like no alcohol on the range, make sure that everybody has their driver's license, and little things and insurance for vehicles. Once those authorities have been verified by CERC, and I also have a point that that I will be able to insert myself in that process to do a random audit on those, then they must cross the gate, at which time all those authorities are again certified to be true and accurate. Once they're within the training area themselves, as we do with any user, they run their own range safety net to coordinate the activities on oil and gas vehicles, but are connected to the larger range control safety net. So if you will, it's a subnet within a net. Yeah. It's obviously done through radio communications, and they also monitor, CERC does, with their own, if you will, little command post that keeps track via radio of where their folks are. It is not GPS tracked, so it's based on trust, and it's also based on the assumption that everybody knows where they're supposed to be going. Once they're inside the block, there are several means of monitoring compliance. The first one is with the range sustainability section. As I mentioned, there are monitors that I have that will go out and spot check to ensure compliance, and that includes within the National Wildlife Area in terms of ensuring people are adhering to the conditions of the NWA permit that they had received. And then finally, I do have other entities, just normal patrols. For example, when I'm out and about touring around, I will check to see what people are about, as well as military police who will be out monitoring activities that go on.
Now, this process.
Excuse me, sorry, Fernando Martins.
Oh, sorry.
I'd like to just add to Colonel Bruce's comments. When range control and range sustainability section have been expanded, et cetera, there has been or there is no attempts to regulate any activities that are currently regulated by another regulator that is enforcing their laws or regulations upon the land. As an example, ERCB has a mandate, and it is ERCB that enforces those rules and laws upon the oil and gas industry at CFB Suffield, whereas the landowner conditions of access, etc., those are in range standing orders, and those are the types of things that range control would help enforce, etc. Just as an addendum to Colonel Bruce's comments.
Okay. Now, when we were discussing with Ms. Boyd some of the incidents, and she referred us to Exhibit 003019, and we don't need to go there, but there appeared to be none listed there for 2007 and 2008, yet she said there were some incidents that occurred, and they were in the presentation. So if we could go to your presentation at tab or page 35. No. It's next page. Now, I think these are what she was referring to, the top pictures. Now,
sorry, excuse me. I'll just clarify that very specifically. The one I'm referring to is in the lower left-hand corner only.
Okay. So I'd like to know a little bit about this incident. And Colonel Bruce, are you aware of this one? Or what we're referring to here?
Just one moment, please. With regards to the reporting of that particular incident to me, I cannot confirm that in fact occurred to me. But to explain the incident itself, I think it'd be important for Delaney to just walk through what happened.
Okay.
Essentially, this was an incident that was noted when we were out on the range, and we discussed it with representative from Encana, Mr. Heese, and he explained to us what happened. And it was a routine maintenance situation whereby, I believe, if my memory is correct, I believe it might have been a swabbing truck, but if it wasn't that, it was essentially a routine maintenance vehicle that was accessing the NWA to reach an area. And in this case, you can see it was fairly sandy soils and it was dry conditions. They attempted to use what I understood to be an existing access. However, the vehicle became stuck, and they tried to access through another access route into the area and essentially created more than one disturbance, as this photo does demonstrate. This was discussed with us, and Canada came to us and indicated that it had what the details were of the occurrence. And we did report this up our chain of command and discussed it within D&D on the base to determine the way forward. Essentially, it was we provided to Encana the ability to fix this. They wanted to rectify it. And essentially, my understanding is that a very simple procedure was applied to the ground whereby the area was raked back into place, recontoured slightly, essentially with people, not machines, and natural recovery is going to be used here to reclaim this area. This was one of the situations where we had a this is a case-by-case type situation when we're talking about remediation and reclamation and correcting of disturbances in the National Wildlife Area, because we do not yet, as I mentioned in previous testimony, have an established set of permit conditions and environmental assessments in place to deal with ground disturbance and associated reclamation of those disturbances in the NWA. This incident essentially represents a one-off situation. However, the question does arise, how often does this occur, especially given the fact that the only reason we found it was an opportunistic find. it wasn't a systematic survey on our part, and there could be other incidents like this, and how are they being dealt with? So there are definitely uncertainties.
I would like to just follow up on the whole issue of the NWA and permitting to allow activity in the NWA. As we've highlighted on our opening presentation, that in order to do activity within a wildlife area, you need a permit for industrial-type activities. As you can appreciate, there's already 1,100 wells in the NWA that need servicing. We have had challenges over the last 3 years attempting to get INCANA to accept the need for permitting. This has been resolved over the last couple of months, where they have now accepted the need for permit for routine operations, what we call it, so maintenance, basic maintenance of the wells, as I've previously mentioned in earlier testimony. There are five areas that still need resolution, which I understand have been discussed in some detail in previous testimony, but we're working towards resolving this. But I think it's important to note that it took a letter, a formal letter, to INCANA, basically saying, accept this permit. We were trying to give it to them. Accept this permit for routine operations, or if you do not, then I have no option but to hand it over to Enforcement Canada, or correction, Environment Canada Enforcement. And it took a formal letter to get that process kick-started, where we now have resolution for the most part on this particular aspect. When it comes to the actual monitoring compliance, now that we have the permit in place, and we are still working, as I said, through some of the issues, I think it's very important to note that until we can sit down with the interested parties and come up with how we are going to tackle some of these issues, whether it be an additional disturbance, whether it be remediation, it proves to be on a case-by-case basis until I have that more formally established. So incidents like this that occur, we will deal with as a one-off. However, we are in the process of trying to establish a more formal identified system that will allow us to proceed.
Just a few follow-up questions from that. Did INCANA have a permit to go out and do this work that led to this incident?
We're not sure, given we're not sure when the date of this particular incident, but I can take an undertaking to find it for you.
Could we have that, please?
Thank you.
And my next question was, and maybe that'll answer it, is when did it occur, and is there some, and where is it close to, if you could give us that information.
Yeah, we'll take that on, thanks.
Now, one other question. When you said it was an opportunistic find, I take that it was the base who found this incident? Am I understanding that correctly?
Actually, what it was actually Mr. Olaf Jensen was conducting surveys for the gold-edged gem, an endangered species on base, and he found the site in a sandy-soiled area of the southern NWA near Dugway Trail. And certainly Mr. Jensen could provide additional details if necessary.
I guess my one question was then, INCANA did not report to you that they had a problem out there. It was found by the base. Am I correct?
That's correct. The chain of events is that Mr. Jensen reported this to, I believe it was actually to Ms. Gunther, on, I'm told, August 10th. And it was then reported to me for NWA-related purposes. And then we reported that up our chain of command. We contacted Mr. Heiss to determine what the situation was and what was happening here, and further discussions precipitated from there.
And did Mr. Hees tell you when this event actually occurred?
We would have to determine that through email correspondence. He very well may have, and that is a detail I'm sure that is possible to determine if necessary.
I think it might be helpful to the panel to see the correspondence that went back and forth around that incident. Would it be able to be produced?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just concerned about closure here. We're now on examination on an undertaking with the request for more undertakings. I don't know how long it will take to get this information, but I am very concerned that it will prolong, and I don't want to object. I do wish to express a concern because I don't know how long this will take.
Thank you, Mr. Lambrecht. I must admit I do share that concern at this point and ask whether this information is absolutely essential.
Well, I leave it to the panel, but it is a recent event on the NWA, and I think it's germane to how things are dealt with and handled. I don't think we need to cross-examine on it. I think it's something they can give you before argument, just so you have it to review.
Ms. Klemig, I think we have a fairly good understanding of the situation at this stage without asking for the details of the correspondence.
That's fine then. I have one last question, and maybe this goes to Mr. Jensen, that you found it while you were surveying what I believe are species at risk. Was this found near an area where there were species at risk, or?
No, it's within a kilometer or so of the Dugway Dunes, which is an area known now to contain gold-edged gem.
I'd now like to turn to the annual reports, 003-55 and 003-054. And this will lead into my last questions on enforcement. Now, these are produced, I guess, annually by their nature. They're called an annual report. Is that correct?
Ms. Clement, can we just wait 1 second?
Oh,
we're
sure.
Getting the copies brought up to this end.
Oh, that would be fine.
Thank you.
But, yes, that is correct. They are produced annually.
And I'm going to start with the first one, which is 26 February 07. Now, are these an internal document?
I can provide some clarity on that situation. This is a report that is produced each year that was mandated through the delegation process within DND. It was determined that higher levels of DND wish to receive clarity and oversight and visibility on what was happening within the National Wildlife Area. So this is a report that is produced by the base, on the base, and then sent up the chain of command as an information piece. I believe the intention is also, though, that it is distributed at some point in the chain of command across to Canadian Wildlife Service, Environment Canada.
Now, your counsel will advise if you're the correct party to answer this, but when we got the one that would have been released through access to information and the one we got here is significantly different. As you can see, there's huge portions redacted, and when you look at the ones that are redacted, it deals with infractions and what is occurring on the NWA. And I guess what I'd like to ask from my client's perspective, when the public asks for information on the NWA and information like that is redacted, how is is the public ever going to be able to access what's going on out there and being a check on whether things are being handled properly? Now, I'll let Mr. Lambrecht intercede whether this is a proper question for you or someone else.
Mr. Lambrecht?
Well, there are two points to be aware of. First, the general process of application for government information under the Access to Information Act and the Privacy Act. And then, second, the production of government information in a legal proceeding such as this one. With respect to the first process, when citizens make access to information requests of the Government of Canada, there's a process that these go through, and the law provides for the documents to be reviewed and for the exemptions to production specified by Parliament in the Access to Information Act and the Privacy Act to be identified and for the documents to be produced subject to those exemptions. I think my friend has called it redactions. And there's an appeal process for review of that. So there is a process that exists set up by Parliament for the production of that material. I think the short answer to my friend's question is that she's free to pursue her internal remedies on this issue, and that what has occurred here is that a legal proceeding has come about, and the same information that had been requested in the Access to Information Act was requested in the legal proceeding. Now, Section 8 of the Privacy Act provides that in legal proceedings where information that is requested is producible, it is not subject to the same exemptions that would operate in respect of a normal application for information under the Access to Information Act and the Privacy Act. So as a result of that, we have produced, as I mentioned a couple days ago, we've produced the unredacted copies to this tribunal. This is in the normal course of things. I think my friend's concern is one for submissions and really not one for the evidence of this panel. So that's my submission to the teaser on that matter.
Thank you, Mr. Lambrecht. Maybe if I could just clarify my understanding, I think what you're saying is that this information is available, but there is a due process that has to be followed in order to get it, and that is the Access to Information Act and the consequent Privacy Act, which has to be taken into account as well.
Yes, sir. I mean, there are many avenues by which government information is produced. This proceeding is a good illustration. One of them is the Access to Information Act, that it operates exactly as you've mentioned. And it was not yet completed when this proceeding, which is another means of accessing government information, was mature. There are many other ways. It's difficult to be comprehensive about it. Litigation is an excellent example. Without meaning to be comprehensive, I think it's fair to say that there are certainly means by which the public can become aware of enforcement issues within the National Wildlife Area. And this particular question, as it's framed, I think is really one that the federal panel, it belongs in submissions rather than in evidence. Okay, here, I think.
I'm okay with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, please proceed, Ms. Kleiman.
But out of that, I guess there's one other question, and perhaps this goes to you, Colonel Bruce, or Colonel Lamar. Has the DND contemplated any way, short of requiring citizens to go through access to information, to make information on the NWA available to the public? It is a National Wildlife Area. Have you contemplated that, or is there any way that this information can be made available other than through this type of process?
I think
like all things, what happens on the base, as you can appreciate, we tend not to allow as many visitors as perhaps others would like, simply because of the nature of what we do there in terms of military effect and also defense research. However, there are a number of forums which we do provide information on or about the National Wildlife Area. And I think the Prairie Conservation Forum, of which CFB Suffield is a member of that particular forum and has been for a number of years, and we attend all the meetings, is but one way. The other way is we've tried to come into the 21st century with our own website and the like, and in there has specific reference to those things that are on or dealing specifically with the National Wildlife Area, as well as some of the activities that are ongoing in there. It's not comprehensive yet. It's still a work in progress, but I'm comfortable that those types of venues do satisfy that requirement.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, looking at this 26 February 07 annual report, at paragraph 7 of that, there's a reference to an infraction, and that infraction was Encana was trapping too close to a known Ord's kangaroo rat den. And I take that was referred to enforcement, but enforcement determined there was no clear indication of infraction. I guess this goes to Environment Canada. What types of things do you look for? And if there isn't a clear infraction, is there anything else you can do about these things to deal with them?
On this particular issue, I really can't comment in terms of whether I would seek clarification from DND in terms of whether Environment Canada was contacted in this case. I really can't comment on that at this point.
The report says the matter was referred to Environment Canada enforcement. However, it was determined that a clear infraction was not present.
I can provide some clarity on this that might assist.
That would be useful.
It was referred to Environment Canada enforcement, and that was through the Calgary office, and we do have a contact there that we work with. The details were provided of the situation, and he looked at that situation and determined that it was not something that he felt there was enough to support a full investigation and subsequent court proceeding or other legal proceeding surrounding it. So it was not pursued further in that regard. And one of the main reasons for that is that the permit itself, in the wording of the permit, there was some question of semantics and interpretation that led to a somewhat questionable interpretation of the situation. It was DND's opinion that it was that the proponent in this case, Encana, acted outside the spirit of the permit. However, that's why it says here that a clear legal infraction was not pursued. It's not to say that there was not, as I said, in our estimation, a situation that could have been dealt with better by the permit holder in Canada. And we, to that effect, sent a letter of displeasure to the proponent to comment on that and be on record that we were not happy with that situation and what transpired as a result of it, especially since it did impact upon research of a listed species at risk.
Now, if we go over to the next page and under G, there was discussion of an abandonment of a well in the Middle Sand Hills. Evaluation of this site by the Base Reclamation Subcommittee is still pending. Is that still the case with that abandonment?
I'm sorry, Ms. Clement, could you specify which paragraph and which subparagraph again?
It's page 6, and it's G. It'll be 12G.
Uh, We have it now.
West Richmond. Yeah, I think that comment actually refers to the fact that the SEAC Reclamation Subcommittee that we spoke about, I believe, yesterday, the processes that are required to finalize that process of reclamation have not been fully developed yet. We were in discussions, and then we're going to be getting back into discussions again in January with the province. And so I think that's what the reference is to, is the fact that there is no formalized process yet, so that reclamation can't be dealt with until that time.
Thank you. And the next one, I think it talks a little bit about what we were talking about the other day. H, Encana conducted a vent leak repair. And although the, although the urgency associated with the repair precluded an environmental assessment, it was noted that emergency repair work in general must be assessed and included in a routine activity permit. So I take it they were allowed to go in and do what they needed to do without the environmental assessment. And that's what you were talking about earlier, Ms. Boyd. Is that correct?
Yes. To clarify, this is actually a good example of the situation that we face regarding emergency work and some of the uncertainties associated with it. This was a situation where it was posed to the base as being an emergency, and it was required that they go in and perform certain emergency work. In these situations, it is my understanding that under SEIA, it is not necessary to conduct an environmental assessment if we're dealing with certainly issues of human safety and health. That was the understanding that the base took, and we provided an immediate response saying, yes, proceed with this work. However, it was some 31 days later that we received an indication that Encana was going to go in and proceed with the work in a way that was not as originally described. It involved ground disturbance, and it was 31 days later, which in our estimation is not a matter of emergency. So the question of what is an emergency and what is covered is certainly something that needs to be determined well before any sort of additional work is allowed in this regard, because in that case, caissons were being excavated and ground disturbance was involved. That was not foreseen in the original request for the emergency work.
Now, I just have a few more questions on these reports, and I'm turning to the one dated 25 February 2008. And I'm going to page 5, and it's 13, and it's tab I. And it says, follow up on Encana's post-construction reclamation practices in the NWA, including several trail reclamation projects, was deferred to 2008. And will be considered by the RSS remediation group. Has that been done?
Just one moment, please. Thank you. There was some follow-up done on some of these sites, and we used the proponents' reports, which indicated that they had found certain types of disturbances and leftover materials, such as cement and different things, left at sites. And we went back out, sent out our field people to investigate some of these sites, and found that in many cases, some of the same materials that were identified by the proponent were still there. And there were ongoing discussions with the proponent requesting that these materials be removed. What this is referring to is going back out yet again to determine if, in fact, that work was done. And we have not, to date, had the opportunity to go and do that.
Now, back to you, Colonel Bruce, and I was discussing this with Mr. Richmond in your absence, and he invited me to come back and discuss it with you. So you can talk to him after. And we were discussing the enforcement that's available to you, and this is it. For ease of reference, if you want to know where this is, it's at page 2892 of the transcripts, but I don't think we need to turn them up. And as I understand Mr. Richmond's, truly, really the only true enforcement you have is to limit access to the companies, is what I understood him to say. Is that true?
Very much so, but there are other mitigation measures that, or other punitive actions that we can take, and I think Colonel Lamar addressed them in the opening statement with regards to the powers of punishment under the National Defense Act and, of course, DCARS, the Defense Controlled Access Area Regulations. That's more abbreviations than I can say. But the bottom line being is essentially those are fairly specific and can be used if required, if I do so determine, with, of course, legal counsel to say whether or not we would have a legitimate case. However, as you are aware, Alberta Environment does not have the authority, less than one or two areas on the base, and they are traditionally, in the terms of Alberta, those that have that sort of escalatory types of powers that can that provide a broad range of punishments for infractions that do occur. Essentially, as it stands now, other than the DCARS and the National Defense Act, it's constraining access. Not closing access, because then we would assume certain liabilities for infrastructure, which I'm sure the average Canadian taxpayer would not want me to assume on their position. But I will give you an instance. For example, in 2004, because of the issues ongoing with industry, we closed the base for all but essential maintenance activities for 2 full weeks. For development, simply to indicate our displeasure with the activities that industry had been performing. I think it's also important to note that it's very challenging to take punitive actions in some cases against industry without being able to tell them why we need to do this. And the why is the operating protocols, or in this particular case, the rain standing orders, Chapter 7, that deals specifically with oil and gas. We have, as you probably heard already, been trying to put these together for over 3 years. It finally, to be quite frank, I issued them on the 8th of August, 2008, after numerous attempts for detailed consultation with industry. Quite frankly, I was very disappointed on a number of occasions that nobody would show up to sit down and talk about these things, because the whole purposes of the range standing orders was to be able to provide something that people could look to as operating protocols on this base. They are not meant to replace any current statutes or regulatory regimes that are in place, like, for example, the ERCB. They are meant to develop on how I wish people to operate on Canadian Forces Base Suffield. That would also then provide me a means to measure how successful they are doing against those criteria. I think it's also important to note that there have been infractions that continue to occur that we continue to address. Traffic violations is one. As I mentioned, not all vehicles are GPS tracked yet. Therefore, we trust the individuals that are out there that they understand how to read a map so they can get from point A to point B in accordance with the access plan. There have been violations where vehicles have moved into red templates, and a red template is where there's live fire going on, and it becomes very dangerous, and once that occurs, we need to shut down the red template until those people are moved out. We have also had indications, for example, from CERC, where people at the gates have been found with alcohol in their vehicles, and they have been barred from entry, and in fact, my understanding is through industry, they take that quite seriously and, in fact, have stripped contractors of their obligations to actually work for them. And then finally, I think what's also important is that I can bar people from the base as a whole. And there was, in 2006, a senior member of CERC who no longer works for that company, but was a member at the time, who was restricted from the headquarters building and barred from the officer's mess because of his conduct in terms of browbeating my staff. And these individuals, this individual is no longer welcome as far as I'm concerned. So though I don't have a full broad spectrum of measures that I may take or as deep as, say, an Alberta environment, I do have a number of measures that I can use. And like I said, though, I need to put certain things in place first, rain standing orders being a key component, so that people know what I'm expecting them to do before I can then enforce some sort of standard.
I just want to clarify one thing, Colonel Bruce. When you said with the RSOs you were disappointed that they didn't show, people didn't participate, is that industry you were referring to?
That is correct. I issued a, and you've heard about the ADR process, and you have heard about a number of activities. My predecessor in 2005 issued the first draft of range standing orders to industry for comment. The comments that were returned were quite scathing and, quite frankly, not very helpful in trying to produce a document that we would have ownership from across the broad spectrum of stakeholders. When I arrived in 2007, I reinvigorated the process and I issued a second draft to industry in December 2005. There were several meetings. Unfortunately, most of the operators did not show up. CERC did on their behalf, but my understanding is there was a number of operators that had indicated that they, CERC, was not to speak on their behalf. The 23rd of July, this summer, was the last meeting. I said, before I issue, I would like to have one more sit-down with industry, and nobody showed. So in the end, I issued a range standing orders on the 8th of August and asked for 60 days. I gave a 90-day implementation period of which I would accept comments back from industry for the first 60 days. And then I would look at those comments to see if I needed to adjust what I had said all along, highlighting that I am not in the business of replacing the regulatory statutes that are already in place, nor would I impose anything that was a threat to health and safety. And I needed their input. I've now received inputs on several from several companies, and I will look at those and see if I need to amend or tweak my range standing orders. I highlight that range standing orders are a living document, meaning that as policies change, I will amend them from time to time to ensure that they remain current and relevant.
Now, I'm going to... I have two areas left, and I'm just going to switch to PDAs, and I'm not going to be long on these. Now, I understand ultimately it'll be you, Colonel Bruce, who signs off on those after they're done on the approval of any individual well and infrastructure. Am I correct?
The PDA process is just part, will be entered as a part of the application for development. I have delegated authority less for those in the National Wildlife Area to my G3, who will sign off approvals, and I retain the right for all denials in the case of the rest of the range and training area. But specifically for the National Wildlife Area, I do all approvals and denials.
Now, this may have been discussed, and I've been away for part of it, so forgive me if I have asked something that's been done. Are you going to be relying on SEAC for your recommendation, or are you going to have some of your own staff look at it as well, independent of SEAC, on things such as relaxation of setbacks?
Are you referring specifically to the National Wildlife Area?
Yes, just that area.
With regards to the National Wildlife Area, the more input, the better, as far as I am concerned. So I will have, obviously, SEAC's input, as well as my own staff, who look specifically at base issues.
And will you also be looking to your counterparts at the end? Will you be using those resources, Canadian Wildlife Services, the recovery teams?
Canadian Wildlife Services and Environment Canada as a whole are an important part of how I manage the National Wildlife Area. And I think it's important to highlight for two reasons. One, they're the experts, and we are relatively new to this game, and therefore we interact with Environment Canada, I would suggest to you, on virtually every issue in the National Wildlife Area. So from my perspective, we will continue that relationship because it's very important. However, I think it's also important to highlight that this is one of many national wildlife areas. So what we do here may potentially have significant impact across the full range of national wildlife areas, and therefore it's very important to keep Environment Canada engaged in the business at hand.
Now, my last area of discussion is on regulation on the base, and I'm going to go back to our access to information, which is 006018, I believe. And I would like to take you to document A018-2015. And my next questions, although we're looking back historically, is to look at how things get regulated on the base. And I'm not going to belabor the past very long, but to use this to get into the future. Now, if we... on paragraph 2 of that, this is a record of a meeting, and if you go down 4 lines from the bottom, it starts, in addition, the landowner's agreement is required before the AEUB approves well licenses. At Suffield, someone has been signing well applications on behalf of the base and contrary to the base wishes. Now, do you know who that was or how that was happening?
Ms. Klimek, I think we've had some discussion already on the matter of words that have been blanked out. I'm not sure that government can respond to this one.
I think Mr. Lambrecht said that anything that was blanked out when it came here could be discussed, if I understood him correctly.
Yes, sir. I'm not going to object to this question. My friend received information that was redacted pursuant to the normal routine access to information process, which allows for redactions in the material that is produced. There is a Section 8 of the Privacy Act, which provides that the exemptions do not apply in the case of legal proceedings. We've looked at this. Our view is that the panel proceedings fall within the phrase of legal proceedings in Section 8 of the Privacy Act. And So I'm not going to object to this question.
Thank you, Mr. Lambrecht. Thanks for the clarification. Please proceed to respond to that question then.
Fernando Martins. My understanding was that the blanked out letters or blanked out portions there referred to CERC. In the past, it is my understanding that CERC had been giving the landowner consent without the basis knowledge, and as such, applications that were going to the ERCB had the appropriate annotations indicating that they had landowner consent, when in fact the base had not directly given landowner consent.
May I just add to that? That is part of the reason for the evolving application for development. And now it is that application for development that, in essence, provides landowner consent once it's signed off for approval, that goes to the ERCB for demonstration of landowner concurrence.
This leads into my next question, then, because I presume that is no longer happening, that CERC signing on your behalf. But when I look through the information we've seen and what we've heard, CERC seems to be playing everybody's role here, and I'd like to understand what that has distilled to today, because we hear you are giving directions to CERC, or you being the base, to remove a well. CERC is signing on your behalf. So what has all of this evolved to in the role for CERC from your perspective on the base?
I think the partial assignment agreement in 1999 is quite clear in terms of CERC's role. I felt, as has been alluded to, that there has been some confusion in the past in terms of CERC's role. The amplification letter, for example, with regards to gates, is just one of my mechanisms to, if you will, reinforce what my expectations are of CERC. Essentially, CERC has a responsibility to collect and remit access fees that stem out of the 99 agreement to us, though not verify that those fees are correct. They are just to collect the fees from industry, and then annually they present them to me for the Receiver General for Canada. Second of all, CERC has, as I mentioned, a range safety function as a subset of my larger range control in terms of monitoring and being responsible for movement of oil and gas activities once they enter the block. They also, as mentioned, have a number of responsibilities prior to somebody arriving at the gate to get onto the block, as well as specific responsibilities at the gate.
Now, I understand that CERC is a subsidiary or connected with Encana. Is that your understanding as well?
They are a wholly owned subsidiary of Encana.
Okay. Now, do you have any recourse if CERC doesn't do their job properly? What ability do you have to issue sanctions or any enforcement vis-a-vis them?
That's an interesting question. I think that there are a couple of recourses that we have not had to resort to, and I think the final one is obviously litigation. But more importantly, we deal on a daily basis with CERC with regards to issues that are ongoing. And as I mentioned in my previous testimony, there was one occasion where a senior member of CERC was restricted or barred from certain places on the base due to his conduct. So there are activities or things that I may impose depending on how these activities fall out.
Now, I've just got two more questions or two lines of questions, and for those, I need you to go to, this is the same document, A01820039, and if we could go to page 3 of 7, and number 13. And I just want to ask you one question out of this. And if we look partway down, it says, due to the absence of trails in the area of, is it Moray Wood? Am I saying that right? G3 Bio is proposing that it be kept as an area of low oil and gas well density for a use as a control and comparison to more heavily wooded areas. And then if we could go to... Wood. Comparison to more heavily used areas. And if we could go to page 22 of your slide, I'd like you to identify where that area is. And there's a...
I believe slide 39 would probably be more useful.
Oh, okay.
If I may. No, just back to the other one, Scott. That's the one. Basically, the northeast corner, right, no, Scott, a little to your left, right in those areas there. As you can see now, the density of the wells, and again, this is just, you know, a snapshot that sort of is representative because it's not to scale by any means. It is representative that Moray Wood and Coriano, which are sort of center east, are the least developed areas on the base in terms of the percentage of disturbance.
Now, they have no status such as the NWA, is that correct?
That is correct.
So I guess my question is, we have some indication that an area that has not been designated as an NWA, from the basis perspective, should be kept at a low density. And is it fair to say that when you have it, something declared as an NWA, it should at least be as protected as this area outside?
As you can appreciate, that was a recommendation from the G3 biologist at the time, saying that this particular area is the least disturbed area. I have, for information purposes, have issued a letter this summer, basically to industry, indicating my desire to keep those two, specifically Moray Wood and Coriano, as well as two others. No new development will occur in there, no new disturbances, correction, no new disturbances will occur in there, and I will reassess that on a yearly basis, partially pending the outcome of the National Wildlife Area. And I do this for two reasons. The first reason is because the primacy of military training is what I'm all about, and to ensure that this training area is sustainable over the long term for the use of military training. Those four areas that I've restricted new development in or new disturbances in, are two of them are heavily used for military operations, and the other two are the least disturbed area from our studies on the entire base, including the National Wildlife Area. However, as has been the case in terms of our presentation here, is the National Wildlife Area is to be used as a benchmark for the other areas of the base if and when, depending on the recommendations from this panel, are such that I might be able to then free up Moray Wood and Coriano for use for industrial activity, depending on the recommendations of this panel. But in the interim, I have restricted development as of this summer in those areas.
Now, if we could go back to our 006018 and to document A01820056. And if we could go to page 8 of 9 of that document. 056, yes. Yes, and I think it, there's a, if you keep scrolling down to page 8 of 9. And this is on blanket refusal at the top there. And we've been talking about regulation, and I think we alluded to this a bit the other day, but we have here the Alberta Department of Energy, and this is a bit of a new player, and it discusses blanket refusal, and I'd like your thoughts on this. I take it Alberta Energy was at this meeting or had some input to the base on their concerns about development on the base at some point. Is that correct?
Alberta Energy attends, or at least in my experience, the last two SEAC annual general meetings. So Alberta Energy is represented at the annual general SEAC meetings.
Okay. Now, at this one, it said Albert Department of Energy wanted to ensure that new RSOs are flexible enough to judge each issue individually. There must not be a blanket refusal for any given energy, for any given area. Now, what is the role of Alberta Energy vis-a-vis the base? Does it have one, or how do you deal, or what role dealings do you have with them?
As I indicated, first of all, Alberta Energy does sit as a participant within the SEAC annual general meeting, so that they listen to the way things are. They also have a large part through their Crown Corporation ERCB, which obviously has a large role to play in terms of technical aspects of oil and gas development on the base. And then finally, they are consulted from time to time, depending on the issue that we're about to undertake or make a determination on.
Now, I guess I'd like your thoughts on that, on the one thing, that there cannot be a blanket refusal for any given area. And if you want to protect an area for ecological purposes, from the base's point of view, or I guess CWS, would not a blanket refusal of any development in that be one of the options you may want to consider if you've deemed an area important and you want to protect it? And I guess that's my question for you, Colonel Bruce, and you can consult with your other counterparts there.
If I may, I'll start, and if Environment Canada wishes to join in, I do encourage them to do so. I think the term blanket refusal is a very broad and all-encompassing statement. I think, as we've discussed over the course of these three weeks, I think it is now, that there are a significant industrial footprint on the base. And that footprint is there. And I think it would be foolish of us to think that it is not something that we have and something that we must deal with. Therefore, for example, in this letter that I issued earlier this summer in terms of restricting new disturbances, I did not say no to new development. If they wanted to drill off existing pads, and I also recognize the fact that there are ongoing activities that need to be conducted to ensure the good order and maintenance of those facilities. So I think a blanket refusal is perhaps not a correct term in this particular case, because there can be no refusal of any activity given the nature of what is already in the ground.
We have nothing to add on that.
So I guess to follow up on that, then, is it your position that it isn't worthwhile looking at some zoning to say where there are sensitive issues, no new development? And I guess the balance here I'm asking you to look at, if it comes down to ecological values versus oil and gas, is it your position that oil and gas has to happen? And that's what I thought I heard you say. So maybe if you could address those concerns or comments, Colonel Bruce.
Yeah, I think you're taking my statement out of context. What I've said was that blanket refusal is not a term I would use, nor have I used it in any correspondence. Blanket refusal seems to be a term that Alberta Energy used in terms of this particular paragraph, or at least that's what whoever was the author of these minutes thought. The reality is there is oil and gas activity occurring throughout the range and training area, which includes the National Wildlife Area. When you say no new development, yes, I can foresee areas that will have no new development. But let's remember that there is activity virtually in every spot of the base, and therefore a blanket refusal to say no to any activity in there is not appropriate.
Thank you. I think you clarified that. Those are all my questions for this panel, and thank you, Canada panel.
Thank you, Ms. Klemek, for assisting us in your questioning this morning and also on previous days as well. I think this may be, since we have to change desks and have Mr. Denstad with Encana come forward to begin questioning, this might be a good time to take a coffee break for 15 minutes and allow that change to occur. So we'll return in 15 minutes.